I don't know quite, I said, with some dubiousness. You're not a proper twister like he was, but that may be only because you've a sense of honour that he lacked. You don't use people like he did. He smiled at that, but with less real humour than he'd shown before.
Oh, but I do, Sassenach, he said. It's only I try not to let it show.
He sat for a moment, his gaze fixed on the little cherrywood snake that I held, but I didn't think he was looking at it. At last he shook his head and looked up at me, the corner of his mouth tucking wryly in.
If there is a heaven, and my grandsire's in it, and I take leave to doubt that last, he's laughing his wicked old head off now. Or he would be, if it weren't tucked underneath his arm.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
A Breath of Snow and Ashes by Diana Gabaldon.
Chapter 34. The Exhibits in the Case. And so it was that several days later we rode into Brownsville, Jamie in full Highland regalia with Hector Cameron's gold-knurled dirk at his waist and a hawk's feather in his bonnet, on Gideon, who had his ears laid back and blood in his eye as usual. By his side, Bird Who Sings in the Morning, peace chief of the snowbird Cherokee. Bird, Ian told me, was from the Longhair clan and looked it. His hair was not only long and glossily anointed with bear fat, but most resplendently dressed, with a high tail twisted up from the crown of his head and dropping down his back, ending in a dozen tiny braids decorated, like the rest of his costume, with wampum shell beads, glass beads, small brass bells, parakeet feathers, and a Chinese yen. God knew where he'd got that. Slung by his saddle, his newest and most prized possession, Jamie's rifle. By Jamie's other side, me, Exhibit A. On my mule, Clarence, dressed and cloaked in indigo wool, which played up the paleness of my skin and beautifully highlighted the yellow and green of the healing bruises on my face, with my necklace of freshwater pearls about my neck for moral support. Ian rode behind us with the two braves Bird had brought as retinue, looking more like an Indian than a Scot, with the semicircles of tattooed dots that swooped across his tanned cheekbones, and his own long brown hair greased back from his face and tied in a knot, a single turkey quill thrust through it. At least he hadn't plucked his scalp in the Mohawk fashion. He looked sufficiently menacing without that. And on a travoy, behind Ian's horse, rode Exhibit B, the corpse of Lionel Brown. We'd put him in the spring house to keep cool with the butter and eggs, and Bree and Malva had done their best, packing the body with moss to absorb liquids, adding as many strongly aromatic herbs as they could find, then wrapping the unsavory package in a deer's hide bound with rawhide strips in the Indian fashion. Despite this attention, none of the horses was enthusiastic about being anywhere near it, but Ian's mount was grimly acquiescent, merely snorting loudly every few minutes and shaking his head, so his harness rattled, a lugubrious counterpoint to the soft thump of hooves. We didn't talk much. Visitors to any mountain settlement were cause for public notice and comment. Our little entourage brought folk popping out of their houses like winkles on pins, mouths agape. By the time we reached Richard Brown's house, which doubled as the local tavern, we had a small band of followers, mostly men and boys. The sound of our arrival brought a woman, Mrs. Brown, I recognized her, out onto the crudely built stoop. Her hand flew to her mouth, and she rushed back into the house. We waited in silence. It was a cool, bright autumn day, and the breeze stirred the hair on my neck. I'd worn it pulled back, at Jamie's request, and wore no cap. My face was exposed, the truth written on it. Did they know? Feeling strangely remote, as though I watched from somewhere outside my own body, I looked from face to face among the crowd. They couldn't know. Jamie had assured me of it. I knew it myself. Unless Donna had escaped and come to tell them all that had happened during that final night. But he hadn't. If he had, Richard Brown would have come to us. All they knew was what showed on my face, and that was too much. Clarence felt the hysteria that quivered under my skin like a pool of mercury. He stamped, once, and shook his head as though wanting to dislodge flies in his ears. The door opened and Richard Brown came out. There were several men behind him, all armed. Brown was pale, unkempt, with a sprouting beard and greasy hair. His eyes were red and bleared, and a miasma of beer seemed to surround him. He'd been drinking heavily, and was plainly trying to pull himself together enough to deal with whatever threat we represented.
"Fraser," he said, and stopped, blinking. "Mr. Brown?"
Jamie nudged Gideon closer, so he was at eye level with the men on the porch, no more than 6 feet from Richard Brown.
10 days passed, Jamie said levelly. A band of men came upon my land. They stole my property, assaulted my daughter, who is with child, burnt my malting shed, destroyed my grain, and abducted and abused my wife.
Half the men had been staring at me already. Now all of them were. I heard the small metallic click of a pistol being cocked. I kept my face immobile, my hands steady on the reins, my eyes fixed on Richard Brown's face. Brown's mouth began to work, but before he could speak, Jamie raised a hand commanding silence.
"I followed them, with my men, and killed them," he said, in the same level tone. "I found your brother with them. I took him captive, but did not slay him."
There was a general intake of breath and uneasy murmurs from the crowd behind us. Richard Brown's eyes darted to the bundle on the travoy, and his face went white under the scabby beard.
"You,"
he croaked.
"Nelly."
This was my cue. I took a deep breath and nudged Clarence forward.
"Your brother suffered an accident before my husband found us," I said.
My voice was hoarse, but clear enough. I forced more air into it to be heard by everyone. "He was badly injured in a fall. We tended his injuries. But he died." Jamie let a moment of stunned silence pass before continuing.
"We have brought him to you so that you may bury him."
He made a small gesture, and Ian, who had dismounted, cut the ropes that held the travoy. He and the two Cherokee pulled it to the porch and left it lying in the rutted road, returning silently to their horses. Jamie inclined his head sharply and swung Gideon's head around. Bird followed him, pleasantly impassive as the Buddha. I didn't know whether he understood enough English to have followed Jamie's speech, but it didn't matter. He understood his role and had carried it out perfectly. The Browns might have had a profitable sideline in murder, theft, and slavery, but their chief income lay in trade with the Indians. By his presence at Jamie's side, Bird gave clear warning that the Cherokee regarded their relationship with the King of England and his agent as more important than trade with the Browns. Harm Jamie, or his property again, and that profitable connection would be broken. I didn't know everything Ian had said to Bird when asking him to come, but I thought it quite likely that there was also an unspoken agreement that no formal inquiry would be made on behalf of the Crown into the fate of any captives who might have passed into Indian hands. This was, after all, a matter of business. I kicked Clarence in the ribs and wheeled into place behind Bird, keeping my eyes firmly fixed on the Chinese yen that glinted in the middle of his back, dangling from his hair on a scarlet thread. I had an almost uncontrollable urge to look back, and clenched my hands on the reins, digging my fingernails into my palms. Was Donna dead after all? He wasn't among the men with Richard Brown. I'd looked. I didn't know whether I wanted him to be dead. The desire to find out more about him was strong. But the desire to be done with the matter, to leave that night on the mountainside behind once and for all witnesses safely consigned to the silence of the grave, that was stronger. I heard Ian and the two Cherokee come into line behind us, and within moments we were out of sight of Brownsville, though the scent of beer and chimney smoke lingered in my nostrils. I pushed Clarence up beside Jamie. Bird had fallen back to ride with his men and Ian. They were laughing at something. "Will this be the end of it?" I asked. My voice felt thin in the cold air, and I wasn't sure he'd heard me. But he did. He shook his head slightly.
"There is never an end to such things," he said quietly. "But we are alive, and that is good."
Part 5. Great Unexpectations. Chapter 35. Laminaria. Safely returned from Brownsville, I took firm steps to resume normal life. And among these was a visit to Masali, who had returned from her refuge with the MacGillivrays. I'd seen Fergus, who had assured me that she was well recovered from her injuries and feeling well, but I needed to see for myself. The homestead was in good order, I saw, but showing certain signs of dilapidation. A few shingles had blown off the roof, one corner of the stoop was sagging, and the oiled parchment over the single window had split part way up, the floor hastily mended with a rag stuffed through the hole. Small things, but things that should be dealt with before the snow came. And it was coming. I could feel the touch of it in the air, the brilliant blue sky of late autumn fading into the hazy grey of oncoming winter. No one rushed out to meet me, but I knew they were home. There was a cloud of smoke and sparks from the chimney, and I thought tartly that at least Fergus seemed able to provide enough wood for the hearth. I called out a cheery, "Hallo!" and pushed open the door. I had the feeling at once. I didn't trust most of my feelings at the moment, but that one went bone deep. It's the feeling you have, as a doctor, when you walk into an examination room and know that something's very wrong. Before you ask the first question, before you've taken the first vital sign. It doesn't happen often, and you'd rather it never did, but there it is. You know, and there's no way around it. It was the children that told me, as much as anything else. Masali sat by the window, sewing, the two girls playing quietly close by her feet. Germaine, uncharacteristically indoors, sat swinging his legs at the table, frowning at a ragged but treasured picture book Jamie had brought him from Cross Creek. They knew, too. Masali looked up when I came in, and I saw her face tighten in shock at sight of mine, though it was much better than it had been. "I'm fine," I said briskly, stopping her exclamation. "Only bruises. How are you, though?" I set down my bag and cupped my hands round her face, turning it gently to the light. One cheek and ear were badly bruised, and there was a fading knot on her forehead. But she wasn't cut, and her eyes looked back at me, clear and healthy. A good colour to her skin, no jaundice, no faint scent of kidney dysfunction. "She's all right." "It's the baby," I thought, and dropped my hands to her middle without asking. My heart felt cold as I cut the bulge and lifted gently. I nearly bit my tongue in surprise when a small knee shifted in answer to my touch. I was terribly heartened at this. I had thought the child might be dead. A quick glance at Masali's face muted my relief. She was strained between hope and fear, hoping that I would tell her that what she knew to be true wasn't. "Has the baby moved very much these last few days?" I asked, keeping my voice calm as I went about fetching out my stethoscope. I'd had it made by a pewtersmith in Wilmington, a small bell with a flat end piece, primitive but effective. "Not so much as he did," Masali answered, leaning back to let me listen to her stomach. "But they don't, do they, when they're nearly ready to come?" Joni lay like the like a millstone, all the night before the waters broke. "Well, yes, often they do that," I agreed, ignoring what she'd nearly said. "Resting up, I suppose." She smiled in response, but the smile vanished like a snowflake on a griddle as I leaned close and put my ear to the flattened end of the flared metal tube, the wide, bell-shaped opening over her stomach. It took some time to pick up the heartbeat, and when I did, it was unusually slow. It was also skipping beats. The hair on my arms rippled with goose flesh when I heard it. I went on with the examination, asking questions, making small jokes, pausing to answer questions from the other children, who were crowding round, stepping on each other's feet and getting in the way. And all the time my mind was racing, envisioning possibilities. All bad. The child was moving, but wrong. Heartbeat was there, but wrong. Everything about that belly felt wrong to me. What was it, though? Umbilical cord around the neck was thoroughly possible and quite dangerous. I pushed the smock further back, trying for a better listen, and saw the heavy bruising, ugly splotches of healing green and yellow, a few still with deep red-black centres that bloomed like deadly roses over the curve of her belly. My teeth sank into my lip at the sight of them. They'd kicked her, the bastards. I wonder she hadn't miscarried on the spot. Anger swelled suddenly under my breastbone, a huge, solid thing, pushing hard enough to burst it. Was she bleeding at all? No. No pain, bar tenderness from the bruises. No cramping. No contractions. Her blood pressure seemed normal, so far as I could tell. A cord accident was still possible, likely even. But it could be a partially detached placenta bleeding into the uterus. A ruptured uterus? Or something rarer? A dead twin? An abnormal growth? The only thing I knew for sure was that the child needed to be delivered into the air-breathing world and as soon as possible. "Where's Fergus?" I said, still speaking calmly. "At dinner, Ken," she said, matching my tone of absolute calm. "He's no been home since the day before yesterday." "Did I put that in your mouth, Akishla?" She lifted a hand toward Felicite, who was gnawing a candle stub but couldn't reach her. "Hasn't he? Well, we'll find him." I removed the candle stub. Felicite made no protest, aware that something was going on, but not knowing what. In search of reassurance, she seized her mother's leg and began determinedly trying to climb up into Masali's non-existent lap. "No, baby," Germaine said, and clasped his sister round the waist, dragging her backward. "You come with me if you are. Want milky?" he added, coaxing. "We'll go to the spring house, aye?" "Want mama?" Felicite windmilled arms and legs, trying to escape, but Germaine hoisted her fat little body into his arms. "You wee lasses, come with me," he said firmly, and trundled awkwardly out the door. Felicite grunting and squirming in his grasp, Joni scampering at his heels, pausing at the door to look back at Masali, her big brown eyes wide and scared. "Go on then, Awirin," Masali called, smiling. "Take them to see Mrs. Bug. It will be all right." "He's a sweet lad, Germaine," Masali murmured, folding her hands across her belly as the smile faded. "Very sweet," I agreed. "Masali,
I know, she said simply. Might this one live, do you think? She paused, a hand gently over her belly, looking down. I wasn't at all sure, but the child was alive, for the moment. I hesitated, turning over possibilities in my mind. Anything I did would entail hideous risk to her, the child, or both. Why hadn't I come sooner? I berated myself for taking Jamie's and then Fergus's word that she was all right. But there was no time for self-reproach, and it might not have mattered either. Can you walk? I asked. We'll need to go to the big house.
Aye, of course.
She rose carefully, holding to my arm. She looked around the cabin as though memorizing all its homely details, then gave me a sharp, clear glance.
We'll talk on the way.
There were options, most of them horrifying to contemplate. If there was danger of a placental abruption, I could do an emergency caesarean and possibly save the child. But Marsali would die. To deliver the child slowly, via induction of labour, was to risk the child, but was much safer for Marsali. Of course, and I kept this thought to myself, induction of labour raised the risk of hemorrhage. If that happened, I could perhaps stop the bleeding and save Marsali, but would be unable to help the infant, who would likely also be in distress. There was the ether. A tempting thought, but I reluctantly put it aside. It was ether, but I'd not used it, had no clear idea of its concentration or effectiveness. Nor did I have anything like an anaesthetist's training that would allow me to calculate its effects in such a dicey situation as dangerous childbirth. For a minor operation, I could go slowly, judge the patient's respiration, and simply back off if things seemed to be going wrong. If I were in the middle of a caesarean section and things went pear-shaped, there was no way out. Marsali seemed preternaturally calm, as though she were listening to what was going on inside rather than to my explanations and speculations. As we came near the big house, though, we met young Ian coming down the hillside with a clutch of dead rabbits dangling by their ears, and she sharpened to attention.
"Oh, cousin, how is it then?" he asked cheerfully.
"I need Fergus, Ian," she said, without preliminary. "Can you find him?"
The smile faded from his face as he took in Masali's paleness and my support of her.
"Christ, the bairn's coming.
But why?" He glanced up the pathway behind us, clearly wondering why we had left Masali's cabin.
"Go and find Fergus, Ian," I cut in. "Now." "Oh."
He swallowed, suddenly looking quite young.
"Oh, aye, I will. Directly."
He began to bound off, then whirled back and thrust the rabbits into my hand. Then he leapt off the path and tore down the hillside, rocketing between trees and vaulting fallen logs. Rollo, not wishing to be left out of anything, flashed past in a grey blur and hurtled down the hillside after his master like a falling rock.
"Don't worry," I said, patting Masali's arm. "They'll find him."
"Oh, aye," she said, looking after them. "If they shouldn't have found him in time, though."
"They will," I said firmly. "Come on."
I sent Lizzie to find Brianna and Malva Christie. I thought I might well need more hands, and sent Masali to the kitchen to rest with Mrs. Bug while I readied the surgery. Fresh bedding and pillows spread on my examination table. A bed would be better, but I needed to have my equipment to hand. And the equipment itself. The surgical instruments, carefully hidden beneath a clean towel. The ether mask, lined with fresh, thick gauze. The dropping bottle. Could I trust Malva to administer the ether if I had to perform emergency surgery? I thought perhaps I could. The girl was very young and quite untrained, but she had a remarkable coolness about her, and I knew she wasn't squeamish. I filled the dropping bottle, averting my face from the sweet, thick scent that drifted from the liquid,
and put a small twist of cotton in the spout, to keep the ether from evaporating and gassing us all, or catching fire. I glanced hastily at the hearth, but the fire was out. What if labour was prolonged and then things went wrong? If I had to do this at night, by candlelight? I couldn't. Ether was hideously inflammable. I shoved away the mental picture of myself performing an emergency caesarean section in the pitch dark, by feel. "If you have a moment to spare, this would be a bloody good time to have a look in," I muttered, addressing this remark collectively to Saints Bride, Raymond, and Margaret of Antioch, all presumably patrons of childbirth and expectant mothers, plus any guardian angels, mine, Masali's, or the child's, who might be hovering about in the offing. Evidently, someone was listening. When I got Masali boosted up onto the table, I was terribly relieved to find that the cervix had begun to dilate, but there was no sign of bleeding. It didn't remove the risk of hemorrhage by any means, but it did mean the probability was much lower. Her blood pressure seemed to be all right, so far as I could tell by looking at her, and the baby's heartbeat had steadied, though the baby had stopped moving, refusing to respond to pokes and shoves. "Sound asleep, I expect," I said, smiling at Masali. "Resting up." She gave me a tiny smile in return, and turned onto her side, grunting like a hog. "I could use a bit of rest myself, after that walk." She sighed, settling her head into the pillow. Adso, seconding this motion, leapt up onto the table and curled himself into her breasts, rubbing his face affectionately against her. I would have slung him out, but Masali seemed to find some comfort in his presence, scratching his ears until he curled up under her chin, purring madly. "Well, I delivered children in much less sanitary surroundings, cat notwithstanding, and this was likely to be a slow process. Adso would have decamped long before his presence became a hindrance." I was feeling a bit more reassured, but not to the point of confidence. That subtle feeling of wrongness was still there. On the way, I'd considered the various options available to me. Given the slight dilation of the cervix and the now steady heartbeat, I thought we might try the most conservative method of inducing labour, so as not to put undue stress upon mother or child. If emergency intervened, well, we'd deal with that when and if we had to. I only hoped the contents of the jar were usable. I'd never had occasion to open it before. "Laminaria," said the label, written in Daniel Rawling's flowing script. It was a small jar of dark green glass, corked tight and very light. When I opened it, a faint whiff of iodine floated out, but no scent of decay, thank goodness. Laminaria is seaweed. Dried, it's no more than paper-thin slips of brownish-green. Unlike many dried seaweeds, though, laminaria doesn't crumble easily, and it has a most astonishing capacity to absorb water. Inserted into the opening of the cervix, it absorbs moisture from the mucous membranes and swells, slowly forcing the cervix further open as it does so, thus eventually causing labour to start. I'd seen laminaria used, even in my own time, though in modern times it was most frequently employed to assist in expelling a dead child from the uterus. I shoved that thought well to the back of my mind and selected a good piece. It was a simple thing to do, and once done, nothing to do but wait and hope. The surgery was very peaceful, full of light and the sounds of barn swallows rustling under the eaves. "I hope Ian finds Fergus," Masali said, after a period of silence. "I'm sure he will," I replied, distracted by an attempt to light my small brazier using flint and steel. I should have told Lizzie to have Brianna bring matches. "You said Fergus hadn't been home?" "No." Her voice sounded muffled, and I looked up to see a head bent over Adso, face hidden in his fur. I've scarce seen him at all since the men came to the malting floor.
Ah.
I didn't know what to say to this. I hadn't realized that Fergus had made himself scarce, though knowing what I did of 18th-century men, I supposed I could see why.
He's ashamed, the wee French gomeral, Massali said matter-of-factly, confirming my supposition. She turned her face, one blue eye visible above the curve of Adso's head.
Thinks it was his fault, I. That I was there, I mean. Thinks if he was better able to provide, I shouldn't have had to go and tend the malting.
Men, I said, shaking my head.
And she laughed. Aye. Men. Not that he'd see what the trouble is, of course. Much better go off and brood about it, and leave me to hame with three wild bairns.
She rolled her eyes.
Aye, well, they do that, men, said Mrs. Bug tolerantly, coming in with a lighted taper. No sense at all to them, but they mean weel. I heard you clicking away with that steel like a death watch, Mrs. Clare. Why would you not just come and fetch a bit of fire like a sensible person?
She touched the taper to the kindling in my brazier, which promptly popped into flame.
Practice, I said mildly, adding sticks to the infant flame. I have hopes of eventually learning to light a fire in less than a quarter of an hour.
Massali and Mrs. Bug snorted in simultaneous derision.
Bless you, lamb. A quarter of an hour's no time at all. Why, I've often spent an hour or more trying to catch a spark in damp tinder in Scotland, especially since nothing's ever dry in the winter there. Why ever do you think folk go to such trouble as smouring the fire?
This caused a spirited discussion of the best way in which to smore a fire for the night, including an argument over the proper blessing to be said while doing so. And this lasted long enough for me to have coaxed the brazier into a decent glow and set a small kettle in it for tea-making. Raspberry leaf tea would encourage contractions.
Mention of Scotland seemed to have reminded Massali of something, for she raised herself on one elbow.
Mother Clare, do you think thou would mind if I was to borrow a sheet of paper and some ink? I'm thinking it would be as well if I wrote to my mother.
I think that would be an excellent idea.
I went to fetch paper and ink, heart beating a little faster. Massali was entirely calm.
I wasn't. I'd seen it before, though.
I wasn't sure whether it was fatalism, religious faith, or something purely physical. But women giving birth seemed very often to lose any sense of fear or misgiving, turning inward upon themselves, and exhibiting an absorption that amounted to indifference, simply because they had no attention to spare for anything beyond the universe bounded by their bellies. As it was, my lingering sense of dread was muted, and 2 or 3 hours passed in quiet peace. Massali wrote to Lyra, but also brief notes to each of her children. "Just in case," she said laconically, handing the folded notes to me to put away. I noticed that she didn't write to Fergus, but her eyes darted toward the door every time there was a sound. Lizzie returned to report that Brianna was nowhere to be found, but Mulver Christie turned up, looking excited, and was promptly put to work, reading aloud from Tobias Smollett's The Adventures of Peregrine Pickle. Jamie came in covered with road dust and kissed me on the lips and Massali on the forehead. He took in the unorthodox situation and gave me the ghost of a raised eyebrow.
"How is it, then, Awirin?" he asked Massali.
She made a small face and put her tongue out, and he laughed.
"You haven't seen Fergus anywhere, have you?" I asked.
"Aye, I have," he said, looking slightly surprised. "Do you want him?"
This question was addressed to both Massali and myself.
"We do," I said firmly.
"Where is he?"
"Woolham's Mill. He's been interpreting for a French traveller, an artist come in search of birds."
"Birds, is it?"
The notion seemed to affront Mrs. Bug, who put down her knitting and sat up straight.
"Our Fergus speaks bird tongue, does he? Well, you just go and fetch the money this minute. Yon Frenchman can mind his own birds.
Looking rather taken aback at this vehemence, Jamie allowed me to usher him out into the hallway and as far as the front door. Safely out of earshot, he stopped.
"What's to do with the lass?" he demanded, low-voiced, and darted a glance back toward the surgery, where Malvar's clear, high voice had taken up her reading again.
I told him, as well as I could. "It may be nothing, I hope so, but she wants Fergus. She says he's been keeping away, feeling guilty for what happened at the malting floor." Jamie nodded.
"Well, aye, he would."
"He would? Why, for heaven's sake?" I demanded in exasperation. "It wasn't his fault."
He gave me a look, suggesting that I'd missed something patently obvious to the meanest intelligence.
"You think that makes a difference? And if the lass should die, or mischief come to the child, you'd think he'd not blame himself?"
"He shouldn't," I said. "But rather obviously he does."
"You don't?"
I stopped short, because in fact, he did. He'd told me so very clearly the night he brought me back. He saw the memory cross my face, and the hint of a smile, wry and painful, showed in his eyes. He reached out and traced the line of my eyebrow, where a healing gash had split through it.
"You think I'd dinna feel that?" he asked quietly.
I shook my head, not in negation, but in helplessness.
"A man's wife is his to protect," he said simply, and turned away. "I'll go fetch Fergus."
The laminaria had been accomplishing its slow, patient work, and Massali was beginning to have occasional contractions, though we hadn't really got down to it yet. The light was beginning to fade when Jamie arrived with Fergus, and Ian met on the way. Fergus was unshaven, covered with dust, and plainly hadn't bathed in days, but Masali's face lighted like the sun when she saw him. I didn't know what Jamie had told him. He looked grim and worried. But at sight of Masali, he went to her like an arrow to its target, gathering her to him with such fervour that Malvar dropped her book on the floor, staring in astonishment. I relaxed a little, for the first time since I had entered Masali's house that morning. "Well," I said, and took a deep breath. "Perhaps we'll have a little food, shall we?" I left Fergus and Masali alone while the rest of us ate and returned to the surgery to find them with heads close together, talking quietly. I hated to disturb them, but it was necessary. On the one hand, the cervix had dilated very appreciably, and there was no sign of abnormal bleeding, which was a tremendous relief. On the other, the baby's heartbeat was skipping again. Almost certainly a cord problem, I thought. I was very conscious of Masali's eyes fixed on my face as I listened through my stethoscope, and I exerted every ounce of will in order to let nothing show. "You're doing very well," I assured her, smoothing tumbled hair off her forehead and smiling into her eyes. "I think perhaps it's time to help things along a little." There were assorted herbs that could assist labour, but most of them were not things I'd use, were there any danger of hemorrhage. At this point, though, I was uneasy enough to want to get things moving as quickly as possible. Raspberry leaf tea might be a help, without being so strong as to induce major or abrupt contractions. Ought I to add blue cohosh, I wondered. "The babe needs to come quickly," Masali told Fergus with every appearance of calm.
Obviously, I hadn't been as successful in hiding my concern as I'd thought.
She had her rosary with her, and now wound it round her hand, the cross dangling. "Help me, mon cher." He lifted the hand with the rosary and kissed it.
"Oui, chérie."
He crossed himself then and set to work. Fergus had spent the first 10 years of his life in the brothel where he'd been born. Consequently, he knew a great deal more about women, in some ways, than any other man I'd ever met. Even so, I was astonished to see him reach for the strings at the neck of Masali's shift and draw it down, exposing her breasts. Masali didn't seem at all surprised, merely lying back and turning slightly toward him, the hump of her belly nudging him as she did so. He knelt on a stool beside the bed, and placing a hand tenderly but absently on the bulge, bent his head toward Masali's breast, lips slightly pursed. Then he appeared to notice me gaping at him, and glanced up over her belly.
"Oh," he smiled at me, "you have not... Well, I suppose you would perhaps not have seen this, milady."
"I can't say that I have." I was torn between fascination and a feeling that I should avert my eyes. "What?"
"When the birth pangs are slow to start, suckling the woman's breasts encourages the womb to move, thus to hasten the child," he explained, and brushed a thumb unconsciously over one dark brown nipple so that it rose round and hard as a spring cherry. "In the brothel, if one of les filles had a difficulty, sometimes another would do such a service for her. I have done it for ma douce before, when Felicity came. It helps, you will see."
And without more ado, he cupped the breast in both hands and took the nipple into his mouth, sucking gently, but with great concentration, his eyes closed. Masali sighed, and her body seemed to relax in the flowing way that a pregnant woman's does, as though she were suddenly boneless as a stranded jellyfish. I was more than disconcerted, but I couldn't leave, in case anything drastic should happen. I hesitated for a moment, then pulled out a stool and sat down on it, trying to be inconspicuous. In fact, though, neither of them appeared to be at all concerned with my presence, if they were even aware of me any more. I did, however, turn away a little, so as not to stare. I was both astonished and interested by Fergus's technique. He was entirely right. Suckling by an infant does cause the uterus to contract. The midwives I had known at L'Hôpital des Anges in Paris had told me that too. A newly delivered woman should be handed the child at once to nurse, so that the bleeding would slow. None of them had happened to mention use of the technique as a means of inducing labour, though.
"In the brothel, if one of les filles had a difficulty, one of her friends would sometimes do such service for her," he'd said.
His mother had been one of les filles, though he had never known her. I could imagine a Parisian prostitute, dark-haired, likely young, groaning in labour, and a friend kneeling to suckle her tenderly, cupping tender, swollen breasts and whispering encouragement as the boisterous noises of satisfied customers echoed through the floors and walls. Had she died, his mother, in childbirth with him, or a subsequent child? Throttled by a drunken client, beaten by the madam's enforcer? Or was it only that she hadn't wanted him? Hadn't wished to be responsible for a bastard child, and thus she had left him to the pity of the other women, one of the nameless sons of the street, a child of no one. Masali shifted on the bed, and I glanced to see that she was all right. She was. She had only moved in order to put her arms about Fergus's shoulders, bending her head to his. She had left off her cap. Her yellow hair was loose, bright against the sleek darkness of his.
"Fergus, I think I may be going to die," she whispered, her voice barely audible above the wind in the trees.
He released her nipple but moved his lips delicately over the surface of her breast, murmuring,
"You always think you will die, petite puce. All women think it."
"Aye, that's because a good many of them do, too," she said, a little sharply,
and opened her eyes. He smiled, eyes still closed, the tip of his tongue flicking gently against her nipple.
"Not you," he said softly, but with great assurance.
He passed his hand over her stomach, first gently, then with more strength. I could see the mound firm itself, suddenly drawing up, round and solid. Massali drew a deep, sudden breath, and Fergus pressed the heel of his hand against the base of the mound, hard against her pubic bone, holding it there until the contraction relaxed.
"Oh," she said, sounding breathless. "Do you?"
"No," he whispered, still more softly. "Not you. I will not let you go."
I curled my hands in the stuff of my skirt. That looked like a nice solid contraction. Nothing horrible seemed to be happening as a result. Fergus resumed his work, pausing now and then to murmur something ridiculous to Marsali in French. I got up and sidled cautiously round toward the foot of the bed table. No, nothing untoward. I cast a quick look at the counter to be sure all was in readiness. And it was. Perhaps it would be all right. There was a streak of blood on the sheet, but it was only a bit of bloody show, quite normal. There was still the child's worrying heartbeat, the possibility of a cord accident, but I could do nothing about that now. Massali had made her decision, and it was the right one. Fergus had resumed his suckling. I stepped quietly out into the hall and swung the door half-closed to give them privacy. If she did hemorrhage, I could be with her in a second. I still had the jar of raspberry leaves in my hand. I supposed I might as well go ahead and make the tea, if only to make myself feel useful. Not finding his wife at home, old Archbug had come up to the house with the children. Félicité and Joan were sound asleep on the settle, and Arch was smoking his pipe by the hearth, blowing smoke rings for a rapt Germain. Meanwhile, Jamie, Ian, and Malva Christie seemed to be engaged in an amiable literary argument regarding the merits of Henry Fielding, Tobias Smollett, and...
"Ovid?" I said, catching the tail end of one remark. "Really?"
"So long as you are secure, you will count many friends," Jamie quoted. "If your life becomes clouded, you will be alone." "Do you not think that's the case for poor Tom Jones and wee Perry Pickle?"
"But surely true friends wouldn't abandon a man only because he's in some difficulty," Malva objected. "What sort of friend is that?"
"Rather the common sort, I'm afraid," I said. "Luckily, there are a few of the other kind."
"Aye, there are," Jamie agreed.
He smiled at Malva.
"Highlanders make the truest friends. If only because they make the worst enemies."
She was slightly pink in the face, but realized that she was being teased.
"Hm," she said, and lifted her nose in order to look down it. "My father says Highlanders are such fierce fighters because they see little of any value in the Highlands, and the worst battles are always fought for the lowest stakes."
Everyone dissolved in laughter at that, and Jamie rose to come to me, leaving Ian and Malva to resume their wrangle.
"How is it with the lass?"
he asked quietly, dipping up hot water from the kettle for me.
"I'm not sure," I said. "Fergus is, helping her."
Jamie's eyebrows went up.
"How?" he asked. "I didn't ken there was much a man had to do with that business once he'd got it properly begun." "Oh, you'd be surprised," I assured him. "I certainly was."
He looked intrigued by this, but was prevented from asking further questions by Mrs. Bug's demand that everyone leave off talking about wretched folk who get up to no good in the pages of books and come sit down to eat. I sat down to supper too, but couldn't really eat, distracted as I was by concern for Massali. The raspberry leaf tea had finished steeping as we ate. I poured it out and took it to the surgery, rapping cautiously on the door before entering. Fergus was flushed and breathless, but bright-eyed. He couldn't be persuaded to come and eat, insisting that he would stay with Massali. His efforts were showing fruit. She was having regular contractions now, though still fairly far apart.
"It will be fast, once the waters break," Massali told me.
She was a little flushed, too, with a look of inward listening.
"It always is."
I checked the heartbeat again. No great change, still bumpy, but not weakening, and excused myself. Jamie was in his study across the hall. I went in and sat with him. so as to be handy when needed. He was writing his usual evening note to his sister, pausing now and then to rub the cramp from his right hand before resuming. Upstairs, Mrs. Bug was putting the children to bed. I could hear Félicité whining, and Germain attempting to sing to her. Across the hall, small shufflings and murmurings, the shifting of weight and the creak of the table. And in the depths of my inner ear, echoing my own pulse, the soft, rapid beat of a baby's heart. It could so easily end badly.
"What are you doing, Sassenach?"
I looked up, startled. "I'm not doing anything."
"You're staring fit to see through the wall, and it doesn't seem that you like what you're looking at."
"Oh." I dropped my gaze and realized that I'd been pleating and repleating the fabric of my skirt between my fingers. There was a large wrinkled patch in the fawn-colored homespun. "Reliving my failures, I suppose." He looked at me for a moment, then rose and came behind me, putting his hands on the base of my neck, kneading my shoulders with a strong, warm touch.
"What failures?" he asked.
I closed my eyes and let my head nod forward, trying not to groan with the sensations of pain from knotted muscles and the simultaneous exquisite relief. "Oh," I said, and sighed. "Patience I couldn't save. Mistakes, disasters, accidents. Stillbirths." That last word hung in the air, and his hands paused in their work for a moment, then resumed more strongly.
"There are times, surely, when there's nothing you could do, you or anyone. Some things are beyond the power of anyone to make right, aye?"
"You never believe that, when it's you," I said. "Why should I?" He paused in his kneading, and I looked up over my shoulder at him. He opened his mouth to contradict me, then realized that he couldn't. He shook his head, sighed, and resumed.
"Aye, well, I suppose it's true enough," he said, with extreme wryness.
"That's what the Greeks called hubris, do you think?" He gave a small snort, which might have been amusement.
"I do, and you ken where that leads."
"To a lonely rock under a burning sun with a vulture gnawing on your liver," I said, and laughed. So did Jamie.
"Aye, well, a lonely rock under a burning sun is a very good place to have company, I should think."
"And I dinna mean the vulture, either." His hands gave a final squeeze to my shoulders, but he didn't take them away. I leaned my head back against him, eyes closed, taking comfort in his company. In that momentary silence, we could hear small sounds across the hall from the surgery. A muffled grunt from Massali as a contraction came, a soft French question from Fergus. I felt that we really ought not to be listening, but neither of us could think of anything to say to cover the sounds of their private conversation. A murmur from Massali, a pause, then Fergus said something hesitant.
"Aye, like we did before Félicité," came Massali's voice, muffled but quite clear.
"Oui, but..."
"Put something against the door, then," she said, sounding impatient. We heard footsteps, and the door to the surgery swung open. Fergus stood there, dark hair dishevelled, shirt half-buttoned, and his handsome face deeply flushed under the shadow of beard stubble. He saw us, and the most extraordinary look flitted across his face. Pride, embarrassment, and something indefinably French. He gave Jamie a lopsided smile and a one-shouldered shrug of supreme Gallic insouciance, then firmly shut the door. We heard the grating sounds of a small table being moved and a small thump as it was shoved against the door. Jamie and I exchanged looks of bafflement. Giggles came from behind the closed door, accompanied by a massive creaking and rustling.
"He's no going to..."
Jamie began, and stopped abruptly, looking incredulous.
"Is he?"
"Evidently so, judging from the faint rhythmic creaks that began to be heard from the surgery." I felt a slight warmth wash through me, along with a mild sense of shock, and a slightly stronger urge to laugh.
Well, I have heard that,
it does sometimes seem to bring on labour. If a child was overdue, the maîtresse sage-femme in Paris would sometimes tell women to get their husbands drunk and,
Jamie gave the surgery door a look of disbelief mingled with grudging respect.
And him, with not even a dram taken. Well, if that's what he's up to, the wee bugger's got balls. I'll say that for him.
Ian, coming down the hall in time to hear this exchange, stopped dead. He listened for a moment to the noises proceeding from the surgery, looked from Jamie and me to the surgery door, back, and then shook his head and turned around, going back to the kitchen. Jamie reached out and gently closed the study door. Without comment, he sat down again, picked up his pen, and began scratching doggedly away. I went over to the small bookshelf and stood there, staring at the collection of battered spines, taking nothing in. Old wives' tales were sometimes nothing more than old wives' tales. Sometimes they weren't. I was seldom troubled by personal recollections while dealing with patients. I had neither time nor attention to spare. At the moment, though, I had much too much of both. And a very vivid memory, indeed, of the night before Bree's birth. People often say that women forget what childbirth is like, because if they remembered, no one would ever do it more than once. Personally, I had no trouble at all remembering. The sense of massive inertia, particularly, that endless time toward the end when it seems that it never will end, that one is mired in some prehistoric tar pit, every small move a struggle doomed to futility, every square centimetre of skin stretched as thin as one's temper. You don't forget. You simply get to the point where you don't care what birth will feel like. Anything is better than being pregnant for an instant longer. I'd reached that point roughly 2 weeks before my due date. The date came and passed. A week later, I was in a state of chronic hysteria, if one could be simultaneously hysterical and torpid. Frank was physically more comfortable than I was, but in terms of nerves, there wasn't much to choose between us. Both of us were terrified, not merely of the birth, but of what might come after. Frank, being Frank, he reacted to terror by becoming very quiet, withdrawing into himself, to a place where he could control what was happening, by refusing to let anything in. But I was in no mood to respect anyone's barriers, and broke down in tears of sheer despair after being informed by a cheerful obstetrician that I was not dilated at all, and it might be several days, maybe another week. Trying to calm me, Frank had resorted to rubbing my feet, then my back, my neck, my shoulders, anything I would let him touch. And gradually I had exhausted myself and lain quiet, letting him touch me. And we were both terrified and terribly in need of reassurance, and neither of us had any words with which to give it. And he made love to me. Slowly and gently, and we fell asleep in each other's arms, and woke up in a state of panic several hours later when my water broke. Claire! I suppose Jamie had called my name more than once. I'd been so lost in memory that I'd forgotten entirely where I was. What? I swung round, heart pounding. Has something happened?
No, not yet.
He studied me for a moment. Brow creased, then got up and came to stand by me.
Are you all right, Sassenach?
Yes. I was just thinking.
Aye, I saw that, he said dryly.
He hesitated, then, as a particularly loud moan came through the door, touched my elbow.
Are ye afraid, he said softly, that you might be with child yourself,
No, I said, and heard the note of desolation in my voice as clearly as he did. I know I'm not. I looked up at him. His face was blurred by a haze of unshed tears. I'm sad that I'm not, that I never will be again. I blinked hard and saw the same emotions on his face that I felt. Relief and regret mingled in such proportion that it was impossible to say which was foremost. He put his arms round me, and I rested my forehead on his chest, thinking what comfort it was to know that I had company on this rock as well. We stood quietly for some time, just breathing. Then there came a sudden change in the surreptitious noises in the surgery. There was a small cry of surprise, a louder exclamation in French, and then the sound of feet landing heavily on the floor, together with the unmistakable splash of amniotic fluid. Things did move quickly. Within an hour, I saw the crowning of a black-fuzzed skull. "He's got lots of hair," I reported, easing the perineum with oil. "Be careful. Don't push too hard. Not yet." I spanned the curve of the emerging skull with my hand. "He's got a really big head." "I wouldn't ever have guessed that," said Masali, red-faced and panting. "Thank you for telling me." I barely had time to laugh before the head eased neatly out into my hands, face down. The cord was round the neck, but not tightly, thank God. I got a finger under it and eased it free, and didn't have to say push before Masali took a breath that went to China and shot the infant into my middle like a cannonball. It was like being suddenly handed a greased pig, and I fumbled madly trying to get the little creature turned upright and see whether he, or she, was breathing. Meanwhile, there were shrieks of excitement from Malva and Mrs. Bug, and heavy footsteps hastening down the hall from the kitchen. I found the baby's face, hastily cleared the nostrils and mouth, blew a short puff of air into the mouth, snapped a finger against the sole of one foot. The foot jerked back in reflex, and the mouth opened wide in a lusty howl. "Bonsoir, Monsieur L'œuf," I said, checking hastily to be sure that it was indeed Monsieur.
"Monsieur?"
Fergus's face split in an ears-wide grin. "Monsieur," I confirmed, and hastily wrapping the baby in a flannel, thrust him into his father's arms while I turned my attention to tying and cutting the cord, then tending to his mother. His mother, thank God, was doing well. Exhausted and sweat-drenched, but likewise grinning. So was everyone else in the room. The floor was puddled, the bedding soaked, and the atmosphere thick with the fecund scents of birth, but no one seemed to notice in the general excitement. I needed Masali's belly to encourage the uterus to contract, while Mrs. Bug brought her an enormous mug of beer to drink. "He's all right," she said, emerging after thirstily engulfing this. "Truly all right." "Well, he's got two arms, two legs, and a head," I said. "I hadn't time to count the fingers and toes." Fergus laid the baby on the table beside Masali.
"See for yourself, ma chère," he said.
He folded back the blanket and blinked, then leaned closer, frowning. Ian and Jamie stopped talking, seeing him.
"Is there something amiss then?" Ian asked, coming over.
Sudden silence struck the room. Malva glanced from one face to another, bewildered.
"Maman?"
Germain stood in the doorway, swaying sleepily.
"Is he here? C'est monsieur?"
Without waiting for answer or permission, he staggered forward and leaned on the blood-stained bedding, mouth a little open as he stared at his newborn brother.
"He looks funny," he said, and frowned a little. "What's wrong with him?"
Fergus had been standing stock still, as had we all. At this, he looked down at Germain, then glanced back at the baby, then again to his firstborn son.
"Il est un an," he said,
almost casually. He squeezed Germain's shoulder, hard enough to elicit a yelp of startlement from the boy, then turned suddenly on his heel and went out. I heard the opening of the front door and a cold draught swept down the hall and through the room.
Il est en là.
He is a dwarf. Fergus hadn't closed the door, and the wind blew out the candles, leaving us in semi-darkness, lit only by the glow of the brazier. Chapter 36 Winter Wolves. Little Henri Christian appeared to be perfectly healthy. He was simply a dwarf. He was slightly jaundiced, though, with a faint gold cast to his skin that gave his round cheeks a delicate glow, like the petals of a daffodil. With a slick of black hair across the top of his head, he might have been a Chinese baby, bar the huge, round, blue eyes. In a way, I supposed I should feel grateful to him. Nothing less than the birth of a dwarf could have deflected the attention of the Ridge from me in the events of the past month. As it was, people no longer stared at my healing face or stumbled awkwardly to find something to say to me. They had quite a lot to say to me, to each other, and not infrequently to Marsali, if neither Breen nor I was in time to stop them. I suppose they must be saying the same things to Fergus, if they saw him. He had come back 3 days following the baby's birth, silent and dark-faced. He had stayed long enough to assent to Masali's choice of a name and to have a brief private conversation with her. Then he had left again. If she knew where he was, she wasn't saying. For the time being, she and the children remained at the big house with us. She smiled and paid attention to the other children, as mothers must, though she seemed always to be listening for something that wasn't there. Fergus's footsteps? I wondered. One good thing, she kept Henri Christian always close to her, carrying him in a sling or sitting by her feet in his basket of woven rushes. I'd seen parents who had given birth to children with defects. Often their response was to withdraw, unable to deal with the situation. Masali dealt with it in the other way, becoming fiercely protective of him. Visitors came, ostensibly to speak to Jamie about something, or to get a bit of tonic or a salve from me, but really in hopes of catching a glimpse of Henri Christian. It was no surprise, therefore, that Masali tensed, clutching Henri Christian to her bosom when the back door opened, and a shadow fell across the threshold. She relaxed a little, though, seeing that the visitor was young Ian.
"Hello, cuz," he said, smiling at her. "Are you well, then, and the bairn, too?"
"Very well," she said firmly. "Come to visit your new cousin, have you?" I could see that she eyed him narrowly.
"I have, aye, and brought him a wee present, too."
He lifted one big hand and touched his shirt, which bulged a little with whatever was inside it.
"You're well, too, I hope, Auntie Claire."
"Hello, Ian," I said, getting to my feet and putting aside the shirt I'd been hemming. "Yes, I'm fine. Do you want some beer?" I was grateful to see him. I'd been keeping Masali company while she sewed, or rather, standing guard over her, to repel the less welcome sort of visitor, while Mrs. Bug was tending to the chickens. But I had a decoction of stinging nettle brewing in the surgery and needed to check on it. Ian could be trusted to take care of her. Leaving them with refreshment, I escaped to my surgery and spent a pleasant quarter of an hour alone with the herbs, decanting infusions and separating a heap of rosemary to dry, surrounded by pungent scent and the peacefulness of plants. Such solitude was hard to come by these days, with children popping up underfoot like mushrooms. Masali was anxious to go back to her own home, I knew, but I was loath to let her go without Fergus there to provide some help. "Bloody man," I muttered under my breath. "Selfish little beast." Evidently, I wasn't the only one who thought so. As I came back down the hall, reeking of rosemary and ginseng root, I overheard Masali expressing a similar opinion to Ian.
"Aye, a kenny's taken back. Who wouldn't it be?" she was saying, her voice full of hurt. "But why must he run away and leave us alone?"
Did you speak to him, Ian? Did he see anything?
So that was it. Ian had been gone on one of his mysterious journeys. He must have encountered Fergus somewhere and told Massali about it.
"I," he said, after a moment's hesitation, "just a bit."
I hung back, not wanting to interrupt them, but I could see his face, the ferocity of his tattoos at odds with the sympathy that clouded his eyes. He leaned across the table, holding out his arms.
"Can I hold him, cuz? Please?"
Masali's back stiffened with surprise, but she handed over the baby, who squirmed and kicked a little in his wrappings, but quickly settled against Ian's shoulder, making little smacking noises. Ian bent his head, smiling, and brushed his lips across Henri Christian's big, round head. He said something soft to the